It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In September, Anthony Hamlet, in the wake of an ethics investigation, submitted his resignation as superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools, effective October 1st. The Board of Public Education continues to look for his permanent replacement through a national search firm. Today and Thursday, the board is holding 5 in-person community input meetings, as well as a virtual session. Elise Pinchback Johnson is a founding member of Black Women for a Better Education. Welcome to the Confluence, Elise.
Thanks, Kevin. Happy to be here.
Philadelphia School Board also knew last September that they would need a new superintendent. They hired Tony Watlington in April. Are you concerned at all about the length of time that the Pittsburgh Board has taken to find Hamlet's replacement?
I am. It seemed like the input sessions came out of nowhere. I think they were announced on May 4th and they're happening this week and today and tomorrow. And that's a bit concerning. It is true that the board wanted to wait until the transition to have the new board members on to start the search. But that happened back in December and now it's May and it seems like the process is just getting off the ground.
Are you worried about who might be out there and available that the district might want to lead the district?
Absolutely. It sounds like there are some high caliber superintendents that have already taken some big positions. And so really concerned about who's left. The board is also in some ways, they're kind of in between a rock and a hard place, because in terms of an interim, PA school code says that an interim can only serve for a year. And so it's not even that they can extend the interim superintendent's tenure too much longer because of the school code. So we're really in a place where it's crunch time.
Your organization played a major role in the election of new Pittsburgh board members. Has the district been as transparent as you would like in the search process?
I don't think so. So our group, we wrote a letter back in September when the transition to an interim was happening. There were about 167 of us that signed the letter calling for transparency in the search and offering our support with the search. We didn't hear back from the board. You know, it would have been great for them to engage some of these people who are excited about who the next superintendent will be. And we haven't heard anything. So it would have been nice. And I think that this is part of the problem with the district, is that they want community input, but they kind of want it on their terms, which looks like last minute and in some ways just moving towards their own agenda.
When the district announced these public input sessions for today and tomorrow, the board requested, quote, maximum community input, end quote. Are you confident the board will strongly consider the public's wishes, the parents' thoughts?
If history tells the story, I would say no. I mean, the district loves to do these, quote, community input sessions, but they don't necessarily feel authentic. Again, you know, when people in the community come to you and offer their support or put together a letter and say, here are some things that we're concerned about, and then you don't respond as a board member, it doesn't seem like you really want that type of input.
The new board members, have they been responsive to you?
In some ways, you know, we stay in communication with the board members that we supported as part of our political action committee. But frankly, I mean, they're one vote. And there are 3 people that we supported. So even when you think about what it takes to get something done on the board, which is 5 votes, the majority, it can be difficult to get things done when you don't have a majority vote.
Your organization, Black Women for a Better Education, also hosted its own town hall meeting about this superintendent search. What did you learn from that event?
We learned a lot. We learned from people who've been in the superintendent role that authentic community engagement is a big piece of it. I remember specifically Dr. Tom Ralston, who's over the Western PA Superintendent Forum, talking about engaging even his detractors. And so when he was trying to get some work done in Avonworth, he talked about, I need to go find the people who don't agree with me and get them on board, because they are the ones that are going to help move things forward. And so we talked a lot about authentic community engagement. We talked about being realistic about the challenges and how we can really kind of get one thing done at a time and not having these, you know, large expectations, but just a really great conversation about just the importance of really thinking about how to engage a community around a search.
Board President Salahuddin said, quote, "There is no more important decision we will make as a board than selecting the right superintendent for our district," end quote. What do you believe are the must-have qualities of the next superintendent?
Integrity. I think that that's number one. It has to be somebody that we can trust. It also has to be somebody that is going to listen to the community and really talk to the stakeholders. It has to be somebody that's willing to make some difficult decisions around our finances, around our district footprint. It has to also be somebody who is going to center student achievement and ensure that this district can educate children at high levels, because that hasn't happened, especially for Black kids, for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. So what challenges or objectives would you like this person, this new superintendent, to focus on early on in their administration?
I would say, number one, figure out how you're going to right the ship. People like to say, oh, the district is running out of money. No, the district's really not. They don't know how to handle the money. So somebody needs to come in, crack the books, have a real transparent conversation about how our tax dollars are being spent, and then figure out how we use that to maximize achievement for our children.
And finally, are you confident that the district will get a quality superintendent and on time? As you said, you can't extend the interim superintendent's term.
I hope so. But if not, they need to talk to the state about how to do something to make some adjustments in the meantime.
We will have a list of the community meetings, the locations, and the times on our website, wesa.fm/confluence. Elise Pinchback Johnson is a founding member of Black Women for a Better Education. Elise, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. The city's opera community is forming a new partnership that brings together the modern day and history of this art in the city. Pittsburgh Opera is teaming up with the National Opera House on educational programs and events such as workshops and career connections. With us is Rebecca Diaz, Pittsburgh Opera's Director of Community Engagement and the IDEA Initiatives. Welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
And, oh, I'm doing well. And Janae Solomon is the executive director of the National Opera House. Janae, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the programs, Janae, can you tell us briefly about the National Opera House?
Yes, the National Opera House is a nonprofit organization that was established to restore the National Negro Opera Company House and to uplift the legacy of Mary Caldwell Dawson and the National Negro Opera Company.
So, Janae, the National Negro Opera Company, when was it formed?
The company was started in the 1940s when Mary Caldwell Dawson auditioned for the Pittsburgh Opera and was denied the opportunity to perform on stage. And she then wanted to create a stage for everyone with talent to be able to share their talent with audiences. And she then formed the Mary Caldwell Dawson School of Music and then the Opera Company.
And just to be clear, this was a place where people were learning to be opera singers, but also performing and sharing the art in the community.
Yes, they were learning and sharing their talents.
So, Rebecca, the Pittsburgh Opera was formed in 1939, and as Janae was just saying, the National Negro Opera Company was formed around the same time. So in Pittsburgh, was opera a segregated art form, Rebecca?
Sure. So opera was actually a segregated art form everywhere at that time. You know, in our nation, we have a very dark history of the fact that lots of the arts were segregated amongst different groups, not only individuals of African heritage, but if you were of Latin heritage, if you were Asian heritage, if you were Native American, there was a very difficult pathway to get into the opera companies at that time. Thankfully, in the past couple of, you know, maybe I'd say decades, we've been making great strides to try to amend that. And this partnership is really hoping to help with that as well.
So when we talk about the opera community in the city being segregated, Janae, ultimately, what kind of impacts historically do you think that had on opera as an art form in Pittsburgh?
I think the major impact is the deficit to the audience. The audience did not get the experience of watching a performance with the most talented people on stage. And this is why we worked with the Equity Impact Center to create a partnership with the Pittsburgh Opera to say, let's give everyone a fair chance.
And Rebecca, what do you think some of the impacts were long term of this segregation?
I think Janae is spot on. I think that audience impact is a really large one. I think that we see a lack of ownership of this art form by audiences that are more broad and diverse, but also from the other side of things, seeing the creative aspect as well. And thankfully at Pittsburgh Opera and nationwide right now, there are initiatives in place to help rectify the fact that we need to see more creatives and leaders of very diverse backgrounds creating these operas, creating the productions, riding the ship and putting things on the right path.
So Janae, is there still a lack of awareness, whether among the general public or even opera fans, about the historic artistic contributions of the National Negro Opera Company, not just in Pittsburgh, but nationwide?
Oh, for sure. There's a lack of awareness right on Apple Street, where the Opera House sits. And the lack of awareness we're measuring by just support and advocacy. If the audience in Pittsburgh and nationally understood the impact of Mary Caldwell Dawson and Pittsburgh on the world, we would have more support.
Yeah, and then some famous musicians and just generally famous people came through the house not just to learn and perform, but also for safety and somewhere to stay when they were in town, like Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Roberto Clemente also stayed at the house, notably. Mm-hmm. Rebecca, this is going to be a long-term project. So how long-term, how long can we expect these kind of initiatives going on in the city?
Oh, I hope forever. I hope that this continues for the rest of my life and the rest of all the lives of those coming after me. Janae has some really fantastic ideas on how to connect with people in the Homewood community. We at Pittsburgh Opera also are very intentional about making sure that we have this be a really well thought out and longevity is a great word here because we want to ensure that we're connecting with those that are in the Homewood community so that the programs we're putting in place really do reflect what those that are living there need. We certainly don't want to come into the community and just say, here you go, here's a bunch of opera programs. I hope you enjoy it. We want to ensure that there's a nice community conversation going there as we keep this going for the long term.
So the partnership between the National Opera Company and the Pittsburgh Opera includes developing curricula and programming and things such as music education, artistic development, and community engagement. Rebecca, what are some of the educational programs that y'all are launching?
So we have a lot of varied things. So I'll pick up like just two of them right now that kind of show the dichotomy of what we're going for here. We have some things that are really engaging with helping to find individuals find their career paths through the opera lens. And that doesn't mean just on the stage. That means on behind the stage as well, as Mary Caldwell Dawson was such a big advocate for, ensuring that there is a way for young people and for people that are looking for that pathway to know that there are very viable career paths through the arts and through opera, whether that's in stage design or in directing or marketing or even getting up on the stage and performing. And we're also looking to do a lot of very fun and engaging community engagement type activities that are going to break that stereotype of what opera is, of this kind of erudite, boring art form for a certain demographic. We're going to try to launch some really fun things with doing carnival type opera performances, big community festivals with food trucks and great events so that we can make opera something very accessible for everybody.
And Janae, Rebecca mentioned that you're going to be doing some programming in the Homewood neighborhood around the house. How are you kind of building a bridge into these communities that have been excluded from this type of art form for many years?
Yes, it starts with partnership. You know, we define equity as creating conditions and experiences of fairness. And right now we're partnering with everyone in the Homewood area, Lincoln Lemington, to create that experience of fairness.
And then, you know, another portion of this is, how are you reaching out to young people? Because as has been noted, opera is often perceived as kind of a very upright art form in the sense that people might see it as stuffy.
It's exposure. You know, we just had Blue here in Pittsburgh, and schools were there. Capo attended, Winchester, Thurston, you know, many schools attended these, the opera Blue, and it's exposure. They were able to see opera and they loved it.
Yeah, if I can add to that too, it really is kind of going into the community, into the schools, into the where people are. I always say that going to somebody else's house first is a great initiative to let someone feel comfortable then to come into your house. If we can go into places where people feel at their most comfortable, then getting that bridging point to come into an opera and feel that there's ownership there is a little bit easier, a little bit of an easier lift.
Speaking about going into people's houses, you know, the National Negro Opera Company was housed in Homewood in a actual home. It's being rehabilitated right now. Are there going to be programs happening in the house?
Yes. So the house sits in Lincoln Leamington, and our goal is to not only have activities in the house, but to start activities outside of the house.
And Rebecca, are there going to be programs also around the city as well?
Oh, absolutely. We have such a great city here. We have such a wonderful community and condensed art scene here in Pittsburgh that we really can take advantage of lots of great places around town to have activations.
And briefly to both of you, what are you hoping the legacy is from these programs ultimately? Janae, let's start with you.
I'm hoping for us to just come together and present great work to the audience.
And Rebecca?
Oh, I think we're going to change lives. I really think opera has a really great power of transformation. And so I really intend we'll be changing a lot of lives through this.
Okay. Rebecca Diaz is Pittsburgh Opera's Director of Community Engagement and the IDEA Initiatives. And Janae Solomon is the Executive Director of the National Opera House. Thank you both so much. And best of luck with your programs.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. In mid-July, the 988 hotline will officially go live across the U.S. for people struggling with their mental health. WITF's Brett Schultes reports crisis centers in the mid-state that will answer some of those calls are facing a significant staffing shortage, with advocates saying they need funding and support.
By being ready to listen, Jane Wildeson helps save lives.
You know, our human nature is that we want to drag people from feeling bad to feeling good. And sometimes you have to let somebody, you have to sit with somebody in their darkness and let them tell the story.
Wildeson manages True North Wellness Services in Hanover. The crisis center serving York and Adams counties will talk for free with anyone who calls or shows up at the door. She says often people just need someone to talk to.
I can't tell you how many times I have, you know, sat with somebody and said, are you thinking about suicide? And they're like, whew, I'm so glad you asked, because nobody has asked me that.
True North is one of 13 National Suicide Prevention Lifeline centers in Pennsylvania. Over the next several years, they will gradually phase out the 10-digit number, replacing it with 988. It's part of a plan mandated by a recent federal law to build an infrastructure to help people who are having a mental health crisis. Advocates say it could avoid unnecessary emergency room visits and offer an alternative to involving police. But Wildeson says her team should be twice as large as it is.
We have 7 full-time staff instead of 14, and we're still maintaining 24/7 coverage. So right now, you know, if there's a crisis at somebody's house, we could potentially go there. We work with all the school districts in York and Adams County, all the police departments in York and Adams County, both prisons.
She says qualified job seekers are hard to come by. One challenge is finding people with a 4-year degree willing to work evenings and weekends for less than $20 an hour. Another is the work itself. It's stressful.
And sometimes we talk to people who are very suicidal. And my first supervisor the other week took a 3-hour lifeline call. And it was a very intense, hard call.
The situation in York and Adams counties is not isolated. Crisis program managers in Chester and Allegheny counties also reported staffing shortages. York County Early Intervention Coordinator Sharon Harlacher says these shortages are a problem all over the state.
That's definitely a component that we're struggling with. And I think the reason why OMSOS, the state entity, is going to be doing a slower rollout in Pennsylvania is just because of that. There is not so far the resources available to give to counties to build up our infrastructure to do this.
She says with funding, agencies could hire dedicated mobile team workers so that it isn't the same people on the phone going out to meet with people at their homes. The state says it will pursue federal funding when or if it becomes available. It is planning to wait about a year before heavily advertising the 988 number. For Kevin Boozle, the lack of attached funding puts the burden on counties that are already struggling to staff and fund their 911 call centers.
This is life or death, and you can't halfway do it.
Boozle is a Butler County Commissioner and president of the PA County Commissioners Association. He opposes a proposal to tack on a $1 fee per month for cell phone users, saying a similar approach for 911 call centers has not raised enough funds. Boozle says the 988 concept can only succeed with enough help.
I would support it if the state had a funding mechanism or the feds had a funding mechanism, and they could create this, and they can create it in a safe manner.
In Pittsburgh, Resolve Crisis Center Director Dr. Jack Rozelle says, staffing issues aside, 988 is already a success story. It's just going to take a while to be established. He compares it to when the emergency medical services became widespread in the U.S. in the 1960s. And there need to be people ready to step up and do the work.
And I think right now there are a lot of people out there who are thinking, you know, we're seeing so much happening in the world around us. How can I help? How can I make a difference? How can I give back? And I think working in crisis intervention is one of the most powerful and rewarding niches or career paths somebody can take.
Rozelle emphasizes that whether someone uses the 10-digit or 3-digit number, they will be greeted by a human voice on the other end of the line, ready to listen. In Hanover, I'm Brett Schultes.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, early last spring, then-Mayor Peduto unveiled his One PGH Fund using contributions from major nonprofits to address community needs. The Ganey administration might still use the project, but restructure it. Thanks to our team, Nick Kanopka, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.